of May 16, 2005, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 450. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 450A comes from the Senate Health Policy Committee. It also received a 24-aye, 6-excuse vote on the Senate floor. It has no revenue or fiscal impact. The bill is defining circulating nurse as a registered nurse who is experienced in surgical procedures and responsible for managing nursing care and safety needs of patients in an operating room. It also requires that a licensed registered nurse perform the duties of a circulating nurse in an ambulatory center, care center, or hospital. It prohibits circulating nurses from being assigned to another patient or procedure while assigned to a surgical procedure, and it establishes that one circulating nurse may relieve another circulating nurse to continue a procedure. This has no subsequent referral, Mr. Chair.
All right. So it looks like I have, is it Connie and Sarah Breckenridge? I mean, Martin, are you going to come up and introduce this?
I will.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thanks. Chair Delto, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor, and I'm here representing both the Oregon Nurses Association and AORN, which is the American Perioperative Registered Nurses Association. With me today, I've got a few experts. These are operating room nurses who can talk more to the substance, the practice, and the experiences that they have. I'm mostly here to give you a sense of how this bill came to you. We had three hearings on the Senate side on this bill, worked through amendments intended to give some clarity to the bill and satisfy concerns that have been raised by other interests. I think that we've got a bill before you now that had a pretty strong consensus both in the Senate committee and on the floor. Probably the thing that's most important to note is that we took special pains to try to address some of the issues that come up in a more rural setting to make sure that we didn't have any unnecessary disadvantages for rural hospitals. Happy to answer questions later either about the process or the substance of the bill, but at this point I'd like to turn it over to the folks who do this for a living.
Thank you very much for hearing us. My name is Sarah Breckenridge. I am a registered nurse that has 30-plus years of experience in the operating room. And this is to everyone concerned with patient safety in the operating room. I ask for support of Senate Bill 450. The environment in the OR is highly technical. It's impersonal and requires critical thinking skills based on knowledge of sciences and anatomical, physiological, and psychological. Each member of the team has focused responsibilities to ensure a safe and humane experience for the patient. I'll kind of identify those people that are taking care of the surgical patient and focused on that one human being. The anesthesia provider, either an MD or a certified registered nurse and anesthetist, focuses on maintaining the patient's vital functions and providing a pain-free experience. The surgeon is focused on the surgical procedure. The scrub assignment, either a nurse or a surgical technologist, focuses on the instrumentation equipment. The focus of the circulating nurse is on the patient and their response to the surgical intervention. The RN circulator watches the big picture of the process, advocating for the patient who, at one of the most vulnerable moments in his or her life, is unable to speak for themselves. We actively communicate with our preoperative and postoperative RN colleagues, providing a safe, continuous, individualized nursing plan of care. The nursing education, licensure, and perioperative competency is what makes it imperative that the role of the circulator in the operating room be an RN. I ask that you think about what kind of care you would want should you or a loved one face the need for surgery. All members of the surgical team are responsible for the safety and positive outcomes as a team. I ask that you ensure Oregonians have the continuous care of a registered nurse throughout their surgical experience, and especially in the OR, in the role of the circulator, whether it be in a hospital or an ambulatory surgery center. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of Senate Bill 450. I'm a registered nurse. I'm a certified...
Your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. Connie Howarth. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm a certified nurse of the operating room. I have over 25 years' experience working in the operating room. 17 of these have been the director of an ambulatory surgery center in Oregon. This is a physician-owned ambulatory surgery center who also supports this bill. Our center follows nationally recognized standards of care for patients undergoing surgery. These are the same standards that are being followed by hospitals. One of these standards includes staffing our operating room with a professional registered nurse in the circulating role, as Sarah just described. The majority of ambulatory surgery centers do staff the operating room with an RN circulator, but there are some who don't, and that is why this bill is so critical. If we look at the state of Oregon as a whole, we continue to build and develop new surgery centers. Our current surgery centers continue to expand their practices. That includes the more difficult procedures and the types of procedures they perform. Also, our patient acuity continues to rise, the same as in other healthcare settings. In an ambulatory surgery center, patient assessment and intervention is done in a very short period of time and at a very fast pace. And a registered nurse is the most qualified health professional to provide this assessment and intervention. I can give you two quick scenarios that happened in my institution recently. One of them is that the RN circulator recognized on her patient monitor that the patient was in VTAC. VTAC is a life-threatening heart arrhythmia that without treatment can move into cardiac arrest. She immediately obtained the necessary medication for treating this heart arrhythmia while simultaneously getting the anesthesia provider notified. Medications was administered in the cardiac arrest was avoided. A second incident I can give you real quickly is the RN circulator recognized her patient was exhibiting signs and symptoms of a stroke. She recognized that these symptoms were outside the patient's normal response of being under IV conscious sedation. She had the surgeon notified, the procedure was canceled, and the patient was treated. If we had proceeded with this surgery, it is possible that this minor stroke could have converted to a major stroke with lifelong debilitation for the patient or even death. These two experiences demonstrate that a patient's healthcare status changes within a very short period of time. This can be with even minutes and seconds. And this is in an environment in an ambulatory surgery centers where we're operating on basically, quote, healthy patients with elective procedures. The registered nurse needs to be with the patient through their total operating room experience. This includes in the circulating roles as we've described. The RN needs to be with the patient as their advocate and for their safety. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
Always the concern that if I don't have a circulating nurse available in a small hospital in Baker City or Burns, Oregon, what's the effect of this bill?
Chair, Representative Butler, I know my understanding from the Hospital Association is that you have RN circulators in every facility in the state. It's not a question of do they exist. I suppose if we got to a point where they didn't exist, that we would all as a state have a really much more serious question to ask. But the effect of the bill would be that you would be required to have an RN circulator to perform those procedures in that facility.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the fact that we want highly skilled nursing staff with great skills and acuity, but if I don't have them available in Burns, Oregon, and that means that we can't perform many of the functions that you're talking about that the nurses have testified to here today, we might as well just shut them down now, Martin.
Representative Chair, members of the committee, you are as likely to not have a physician in Burns, Oregon to perform the surgery as you are to not have the circulating room nurse in Burns, Oregon. It's the same dilemma for any healthcare professional. You can't do certain procedures if the people who have those skills aren't there. I just don't know how this is a different dilemma.
Okay.
Representative Cameron.
Just to follow up to Representative Butler's, Martin, currently in Burns, Ontario, is somebody else in that operating room? than a registered nurse? Currently, what's the procedure happening out there?
Representative Cameron.
Or may happen.
At this point, the hospitals in Oregon have testified in the Senate side, and we believe it's true as well. The hospitals in Oregon are using an RN circulator as a standard practice. This is a situation that we are concerned with in other states where they're beginning to move away from using an RN in those roles and using CNAs or other assisted personnel to do a circulating function. But in Oregon, our understanding is hospitals all do this and that there are RN circulators available in every facility.
So if they're doing it, why do we need a law? Tell them to do it.
One is preventative, to make sure that trends around the rest of the country don't occur here, and the other is what Connie described, which is we have ambulatory surgical centers which are beginning to perform surgeries that have historically been done in hospitals, and in those situations you don't always have a circulator, and that is a problem that we're facing in Oregon. It's a rare problem, but it's a real one in the places it's being done.
Sarah again, Sarah Breckenridge. One thing, you know, in the state of Oregon, we have a high number of uninsured Oregonians. And the fact, the ramification of that is they wait longer to come to the hospital when they're sick. That means it's a higher acuity. It's a more serious. Instead of when they have a lower quadrant pain and they come to the hospital and it's diagnosed as appendicitis and they've waited and waited, it most probably could be ruptured, and it goes into a whole higher, lot more complicated surgery that we need to do. And thus, it is imperative that for the patient's safety that you have qualified, educated, licensed personnel providing these procedures. One instance of a stroke or of a cardiac arrest, I have one example in my hospital where we started to see the heart slow down, Brady down, and it was the nurse that noticed it. The surgeon and the anesthesiologist were going, well, this doesn't quite fit. It doesn't fit with, and it was a nurse that went out and got the defibrillator, came in, put the patches on, and started pacing that patient while they're trying to decide what to do. Now, would you want to have a certified nursing assistant with 6 months of training in there in that same role? Would you rather have someone who has 2 to 4 years of education trained in the sciences to be able to monitor that patient as well? We're a collaborative group that works in the operating room, and it takes all focuses to be able to make this a safe place. And with the national media focusing on patient safety, why would we want to do anything less in the state of Oregon for our citizens?
And one more thing, may I speak?
Sure.
As a whole, our population is aging. We all know that. With that comes a higher acuity and special health care needs. And in my environment alone, we've seen that greatly increase in the last 17 years. And the two recent scenarios I'm giving you, these are happening more and more often. And you need somebody with the education and the training. It doesn't matter where the setting is. If they're having surgery, they need to have safe patient care provided. And a registered nurse is the most qualified person for that.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard testimony that the hospitals are saying this is okay. Have you had information come forward on the other folks that have these ambulatory care centers? Have they come forward and said this is a good thing?
Chair Delta, Representative Butler, and the Hospital Association is here. I don't want to speak for them. I'm just relating what we heard in testimony. You could certainly bring them forward. But in terms of the ambulatory centers themselves were not represented. The Oregon Medical Association was part of the conversation. Many ambulatory centers are physician-run. In the Senate side, OMA's position is that ambulatory centers should come out of the bill. Our response, which seemed to be the prevailing sentiment of the committee, was that if this is a standard of safety for a surgery in a hospital, it should be a standard of safety for a surgery in an ambulatory center. But I think you may be able to interpret OMA's position as one of concern from ambulatory surgical centers.
Mr. Chair, do we know if ambulatory care centers or ambulatory surgery centers, as Martin has just called them, have a definition at law? Are dentists going to be affected?
So.
Where they're performing procedures under a certain amount of anesthesia?
I don't have an answer to that question. Martin.
With your permission, Chair Delta, Representative Butler, there is actually a license for ambulatory surgical centers. I think the answer to, I don't know the answer to the question of a dentist. I know that there are folks who perform surgeries on the gums, and actually, in terms of whether or not the dental practice would be covered by ambulatory surgical centers and that license or not, you may have a better, my experts here may have a better sense, or I'll just answer, I don't know.
It's more office-based surgery, and so that's not addressed in this bill.
It wouldn't be an OR procedure.
Yeah.
What about the issue that Representative Butler raises about the staffing levels in the smaller communities that are performing surgery and the available pool of folks to be able to work there? I imagine that probably very little major surgery gets done in some of those smaller communities. It would be my supposition that we might go to some larger communities. Representative Butler might correct me if I'm wrong, but to have more significant surgical procedures.
Mr. Chair, it's been indicated by the witnesses, those folks have said, hey, when you've got the potential of a burst appendix, you just go ahead and take care of it. And I'd sure hate amongst the nurses that we have available in these small communities, whether it be in Lakeview in Southern Oregon or up in the mountains in Baker County, that they couldn't do these kinds of procedures because they didn't have a circulating nurse available. I'm just concerned about this policy of one size fits all. And then with regard to these ambulatory care centers or ambulatory surgical centers that are licensed by the state to now mandate that they have to have a circulating nurse, I'm concerned about the cost of the procedures at that particular point. That these folks may not have nurses available with those skills, and that the cost of those procedures would skyrocket if you have to go out and bring in new additional people to assist in those particular. And of course, in rural eastern Oregon, we just most of ours have just been going to Idaho because we just don't have that where the population centers are really located, those ambulatory surgical centers for tonsillectomies and those kinds of things. You just line them up at recess and take them out with piano wire, is what we used to do, but not anymore.
All right. I don't know if I believe that. All right, thanks very much.
That's why he's so tough.
Lost my singing voice at that point.
Scott Gallant, woman.
I had mine taken out in a doctor's office. So, worst experience other than the dentist that I went to those days that I remember.
Never had mine out.
Oh, you're fortunate. You came at the right time.
All right. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this bill a little bit. I believe you're being handed my written testimony. To make a few comments about the bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions as well. There is actually a plethora of requirements regarding staffing for surgical procedures in ambulatory surgical centers and clearly in outpatient hospital facilities in the state. They all follow appropriately Medicare, JCO, and ambulatory surgical accreditation organizations staffing standards. This bill, I think even the proponents would agree that in current facilities, whether they be ambulatory surgical centers or otherwise, do in fact provide circulating nurses for operations. The concern, as I understand it, is that there have been some states, and Medicare does not set the bar to the level that the nursing association would prefer it be set. And so they're anticipating that there could in the future be some concern about staffing in operating rooms by circulating nurses. But the problem does not exist today in this bill was drafted to address a future potential problem. We have pointed out on the Senate side that we thought that ambulatory surgical centers, in fact, should be pulled out. I do have a potential amendment which I had drafted for the Senate side that would have said that a hospital or ambulatory surgical center that complies with acceptable standards as evidenced by a certificate from the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations shall be deemed to comply with any staffing requirements related to the duties performed in an operating room established by Oregon law. The ONA did not find that amendment acceptable. I would still offer it as a realistic alternative if the committee so chooses. The other concern is that anesthesia is not defined. There is a great deal of minor surgery performed in ambulatory surgical centers, and as well as very serious surgical operations. I believe that the approach of the proponents of the bill is that can be addressed by rule. I think it would be probably a better approach to actually address it in the statute, so that it is not so overreaching that you could, in fact, inappropriately require minor procedures where anesthesia is used, and there are variations of anesthesia, as you know, that technically you could say, well, anesthesia is being used for fixing a laceration, therefore you have to have a circulating nurse. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the appropriate policy that you might want to adopt. In response to Representative Butler's comments, I think that this clearly says that if you have an operation in a rural facility, you have to use a circulating nurse, and I believe everyone's aware that there's a nursing shortage, and we're soon to be, if not already, in the middle of, I keep saying this, in a physician shortage, and it's going to get worse, then you have to have another circulating nurse be there to substitute for the first circulating nurse who may, for whatever reason, leave the operating room. So it's not just one nurse that you have to have trained and appropriately there, but you're going to have more than one. We think it's going to have some impact on the ability to schedule surgeries and costs, obviously, involved in this process. So we too are obviously very cognizant of making sure that medical errors don't occur in patient safety, et cetera. We don't know that this necessarily adds to that issue area, and would appreciate any consideration the committee might have in maybe refining the terms of this bill to some degree. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we've got oral surgery going on, then that's a surgical procedure. Am I going to have registered nurses, a staff of two trained registered nurses available for those surgical procedures, Scott?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I don't believe so. Actually, there is a definition of ambulatory surgical centers. I would give you a statutory reference. I'm pretty sure it's 440. It's either 441 or 442, 065, is my recollection. But I'm probably wrong. I'm trying to kill another awful bill on the other side. So I've been paying attention to it lately. Nevertheless, I don't believe that it would include dental surgery, as I understand it. I could be wrong, and you might want to have your counsel look at it. In that process. Now, it clearly would affect maxillofacial surgeries, I suspect, which are typically DMDs with MD degrees. I believe the definition for ambulatory surgical centers I'm over 50, so memory could be slightly wrong, are any procedures that are not ordinarily done in a physician's office. So DMD, maxillofacial physicians would, I suspect, be impacted. That's a long answer to a short question. I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
No apologies. Okay. Representative Butler, do you have anything else?
No, I
may not be 065.
442-065 deals, or 441-065 is exemption of certain religious institutions.
Right. There's probably earlier in the chapter under the definitions, probably the correct.
Let me go through that. I think it is in healthcare facilities.
The certificate of need
441.
Yes, it is.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if there are amendments available to help us define anesthesia to work on the necessary presence issue of the circulating nurse under certain circumstances that the Oregon Medical Association has. Maybe we should take a look at those.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Okay. Jennifer French, Gloria Royal, and Mark Fees. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Dalto and members of the committee. I'm Jennifer French, and I'm a registered nurse, and I have the title of circulating nurse. And I think part of the confusion is in the rural setting that you're differentiating a circulating nurse from a registered nurse, and we wear those titles simultaneously. I was born and raised in a rural community, and so I'd like to speak with Representative Butler on the rural setting, as well as Gloria here, who currently manages a rural setting. We have an operating room.
Sir, Director Collins, to the chair.
Sure.
Thank you.
Representative Dalto.
That way,
and the
in
committee.
Future time, it's so adversarial.
Okay.
Not that this one will.
Representative Dalto and committee. I was born and raised in a rural community, and I've served as a registered nurse in those communities where we have only two operating rooms. And even in our rural setting, whether it was Idaho, Washington, or Oregon, because I've worked in all three states, we have had a registered nurse serve as circulator. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is the uniqueness of this, of what a circulator does is that we are the last safety net. We are the last person to catch mistakes before you go to the operating room, and I think that is key. And I don't think whether you are a nurse in Portland in a big facility or whether in your rural setting, that's going to change. And that's all I have to say. Gloria. Any questions?
Good morning, Representative Dalto and committee. I'm Gloria Royal. I am an operating room nurse and have been for more years than I can think of, you know, 20 plus. I have been working for the last year in a rural hospital and have also worked in one previously. I would like to relay a story that happened recently to me, and maybe it will help tell why an operating room nurse should be a registered nurse in the circulator. Because of my experience and my training, I have the ability to assess patients, and I also have that ability to stand up for the patient when it's required and to be the patient delegate. I was in the outpatient department getting ready to take a patient to surgery and had done the assessment and the interview with the patient. And the patient very vocally said, "I'm not going, I don't want to have this surgery." At that point, I stopped. and ask for the surgeon to come and join me at the patient bedside. The patient was nervous, was scared, and the doctor said, we've gone over this. I've told you what's going to happen. Take her right now into the operating room. And I said, no, I cannot take her. She continued to ask him questions, ask him if she was going to die. He didn't answer. He looked at me, and he said, you take her right now into the operating room. And again, I said no. He got very red-faced, but I didn't take her in. And finally, he did turn to her, and he explained to her that if she didn't go in and have the surgery, she probably was going to die. Well, you know, she thought about that a little bit, and finally she said, well, then I will go have the surgery. And at that point, then I took her in, and we did the procedure. She did very well. But without someone there to, you know, be an advocate for that patient, she possibly could have been taken in, and you know, hopefully the outcome still would have been a good outcome. But if a patient at any point says no, then we need to stop. And that is part of our role. And I think that with our training and our experience, we have that ability to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Mark Ease. I work at two hospitals, both a large and a small, and the role of the circulating nurse is a continuous and day-long process. I don't necessarily have a particular story or a particular event to bring to mind for you to consider, but I would ask you to consider the continuous vigilance that we provide for patients who have no way of expressing their needs or concerns. Physiological changes occur within 30 to 60 seconds after anesthesia, and my job as a circulator and as the nurse for that patient is to ensure that they have protection, maybe as simple as reminding the fellow team members where they're placing their hands. If you're working on a person's neck, the eyes are right there. If an instrument is laid up on the drapes, which all you're seeing is a small area here, you have potential for injury to happen to an eye in a very short period of time, within a minute or two. Intraocular pressure changes can happen, and vision could be affected either long or short term. That's one example of a myriad of concerns and actions that I tend to take or potentially need to take during a day with a patient or with any of the patients that I care for. The need for training is imperative. One nurse cannot provide excellent care when they are trying to circulate more than one case. So there are inevitably cases when you have such a difficult or a variety of procedures happening simultaneously that more than one nurse is in the room circulating for that patient. Those are rare, but they do happen. Nurses provide care that is not fulfilled by other team members and would be very important for the positive outcome for all patients. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thanks very much for your perspectives. Representative Cameron and Anderson.
Maybe you can explain to me the difference between an RN regular and an RN who's a circulator and somebody who is not even an RN that might be potentially in these rooms or acting in. You say it's not happening today, but what level of person and their training compared to the circulator? Can you talk a little bit about the training differences besides experience in the rooms?
In many operating rooms, there is a surgical technologist who is the person who is scrubbed in at the field and helps the doctor hands instruments. That also can be an RN. The registered nurse is the circulator and is on the periphery, and it, the room is her responsibility, hers or his responsibility, and making sure that all of the standards set down by AORN are followed with sterile sterility, whatever. Now, with training, you do not have to go to a school to be trained as a tech. You can be trained currently in a hospital. The length of time is not defined. Many OR techs are service trained. And then, you know, there is Mount Hood has a two-year program, so there are many variations. The operating room, first of all, must be a registered nurse. And then there is a program, and that can be defined by each individual hospital. We recently, in our national organization, have set down a statement on defining the educational level. I happen to be part of an educational consortium that is part of OR Managers, and we meet every other month in Portland. And we have spent the last several years defining the curriculum that establishes a continuity for training throughout all programs in Oregon, whether it's the one at Mount Hood or one that our particular chapter of AORN has every year through a community college. So we teach not only circulating skills, and but we teach also how to scrub, so that the nurses know what's going on the field, which gives them a better ability to evaluate.
Follow-up. Thank you. So what I think I just heard is that a rural hospital, such as Representative Butler is referring to, could actually just take an RN and do whatever training they deem necessary and say, now you are, quote, a circulating nurse? So I don't have to send them to Portland to a nursing school or anything.
No, they can be trained on the job by experienced circulating nurses. You can have an ADN degree and be an RN. You can be a BSN degree and be an RN. But you don't have to go to any special place to have specific training. You can get on-site training if there are qualified individuals to follow you through a program. But anybody in Bend or Ontario who is a registered nurse and wants to work in surgery will then take on the title as circulating RN, but they're still an RN. It's they're not separate. It's just how we title ourselves in the OR. That's our, you know, when we document on the record, we're the circulating nurse. We're the one that's active in the room, and the person, as Gloria described, who's handing the instrument is sterile, really can't move very far from the field because they're in sterile gowns, and they hand the instruments. That's their specialty, is more or less to hand the doctor what he needs to get the case done. The circulating nurse is overseeing everything else in the room that has to do with the patient's care directly. But you could be an ADN nurse, a BSN nurse, but RN, a registered nurse, you know, does take on the title as circulating nurse when they're in the operating room.
Just one more question. So we're just trying to get this in my mind. We're going to make a state law that says we have to have a circulating nurse in every operating room, but we don't have any statewide criteria that says what the level that person's been trained on. Is that, would that be correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
No?
We're stating that
there's what? Well,
can't.
Hang on a second. Why don't we invite whoever wants to talk?
Martin.
One person. And take a minute to figure out your answer before you come up. All right, we'll get the answer to your question, Representative Cameron.
Thanks.
Representative Anderson, consult with whoever you need to consult with back there. It sounded like there were some opinions. Representative Anderson, you have a question for this panel.
Yeah, my question really follows up on Representative Cameron, and that is that do you have circulating nurses now, I assume, that are not RNs, and that can they, through years of experience, get to the place where they could function as circulating nurses?
Currently, at any facility I've worked at, no one has been circulating who is not a registered nurse.
That's the same for me also.
And me. I've not worked anywhere where the circulator has not been a registered nurse.
So you're just asking us to formalize the fact that they have to be.
Yes.
And you've worked in rural hospitals mostly.
I've worked in all levels of hospital, but yes, several rural hospitals.
Okay, sure. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You'll have to reintroduce yourself before you speak.
Yes, Chair Dalton, members of the committee, Martin Taylor, for the record, to answer a quick question. Sir, I can give you a little bit more of the substance, but under the law, the distinction that's being made is an RN circulator has to be an RN. In order to use the title RN, you have to be a licensed registered nurse. But the circulator function is a specialty of nursing, just like any other area of nursing would be. There is training for that. It can happen in the hospital, but there is also a certification that you can receive nationally from ARN. But there isn't anything in the law that says that any registered nurse couldn't do this function. Now, someone could be challenged to the Board of Nursing and say to the Board of Nursing, this was a person who didn't have enough experience to be doing this function, and your nurse might face discipline on her license if she was truly doing something that she had never been prepared to do. But the law is not going to say this is a subgroup of nurses who are on circulators and you can only use them. This is going to be a decision for the hospital and a nurse taking responsibility on her license to determine if they're qualified to do it. Is that?
For the record, Sarah Breckenridge again. Thank you, Representative Dalton and the committee. Mm-hmm. What this bill is trying to say is that the assignment of the circulating position in the operating room should be an RN, and by the basis of our training, the specialty in human sciences as well as anatomy, physiology, etc., that we are the ones that are most qualified to fulfill the function of circulating. We have our basic training in nursing. We go through OB, we go through med-surg, ICU, etc., as well as some experiences in the operating room. And if a nurse, a new graduate, comes out of school and they go to work for an OB department, they are going to have a certain orientation before they become a primary practitioner within the OB realm. It's the same thing in the operating room. You have your basic RN training, and then when you go into the operating room as your specialty, you will have further training in terms of that. And by our Nurse Practice Act, we cannot function as a primary circulator until we are fully qualified. We have national standards set by AORN as to what the circulating nurse should be. So what this bill is really about is that the person in the assignment of the circulator within the operating room must be a registered nurse. There are some examples even within our state now where some institutions are using non-nursing in the role of the circulator, and that is why this bill is so important for the level of safety of our patients, that the person assigned to the role of circulator within the operating room be a registered nurse that is experienced in the specialty of the operating room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my good colleague, Representative Greenleg, pointed that out, that that's what we're trying to do here. So can you talk about the difference in training between an RN and those other people that you say are potentially in those rooms?
in the room, as I described before, you'll have the physician who is a surgeon. There would be a physician or an advanced practice registered nurse who's in the role of anesthesia. And then in the role of the scrub person, that is a person that is gowned, gloved, handing the instruments to the and at the sterile field. That role can be filled either by a nurse who is a registered nurse or an LPN or by a surgical technologist. And then there's the role of the circulator. The difference of training between, say, a surgical technologist and a registered nurse, a surgical, which some people, that's what other institutions are at this time sometimes using as a surgical technologist.
As the circulator.
In the circulating role. The difference in those two trainings is that the number one, there is not a quantified standard for education for surgical technologists at this time. There are programs that are associate degrees. There are programs where they're on-the-job training, and it could be 6 weeks, and they're doing that function and calling themselves a surgical technologist. In their formal training, if they were to go and get their associate degree, say, from Mount Hood Community College, they are trained in the instrumentation, the equipment, it's high technology in that environment, the equipment, in the sterile processing, there's another hole, we've got to assure that our instruments are sterile, that our equipment is running, is functioning. They are formally trained in that aspect. The registered nurse is trained, formally trained, in the human sciences, in the physiological sciences, and as a circulator who is roaming around the room supporting the surgeon who is focused on the procedure. Their focus is coming in and doing that procedure. The anesthesia provider is focused on keeping that patient pain-free. The surgical technologist or the registered nurse in the role of the scrub person is focused on making sure that they've got all the instruments here and in the hand of the surgeon by the time he needs them. And if there's another part of the procedure coming up, that equipment is on the back table ready and going. The registered nurse is supporting them in terms of getting the equipment, keeping, you know, the equipment is outside of the sterile field, and if something goes wrong, we're the problem solver for that. If there's additional instrumentation that's needed, because once we've gotten into the procedure, we find that it's more than what we originally thought, then we go get the instrumentation for that. But at the same time, our focus is on that patient as a human being. We can see under the drapes, which the surgeon and the surgical technologist or the scrub person can't do. We can see whether an arm falls off the arm board and could conceivably cause nerve damage. We are constantly reassessing the position of that patient, the physiology of that patient. We're watching those monitors as well as the anesthesia provider. And so it's the total picture, and we're the ones that are there saying and knowing the standards and saying, you know, we should be thinking about this, we should be thinking about that. I can use one example. Stop me if you need to. I can use one example in the OR that I work in, which is a two-room OR. We do total joints. We do total hip replacements. We do total knee. We do total shoulders, which is the majority of what we do, even though we're a small hospital. But we have the staff that can do it. We had a situation where it was a very warm, humid day. We have an old facility. The humidity in the room started to go way above standard, and there are many ramifications to that, and of which the surgeon wasn't really well aware of those standards. What he wanted to do was focus on the procedure, getting it done, and doing the next one. We had to cancel the procedures for that day due to patient safety, because if the humidity of the room is above a certain extent, we start getting sweating on the walls, of which we did. We start getting sweating of the people at the field, which could drop into the wound, cause infection, but it also compromises everything that's going on in terms of maintaining that. The surgeon wasn't aware of those standards, and we had to educate him to let him know it is not safe to do this next total joint procedure. You're putting yourself and the patient in jeopardy by taking this chance. It is best to postpone it and do it another day until we can get our HVAC going and working with engineering on that. We did do that. But it wasn't after there was a lot of discussion with the surgeon and helping them understand that this was not a safe environment for these next patients. Another situation where the surgeon was actually too old to be operating, and myself as the manager of the unit had to work with him to help him realize he's not operating safely when he has the flu. And just because he wants to get the cases done is not safe for his patients. And once he was pulled aside, could take a breath and realize, you know, it is better for the patient to do it another day than to have an ill surgeon. So those are just some of the examples of what goes on in the operating room and the reason that you need to have a professional, licensed, registered nurse in the role of the circulator, advocating for the patient and looking at the patient as a whole being instead of just a procedure, pain management, or an instrument. I think you would want that.
All right. Thanks. Thanks very much.
You got a just very quick. Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron. The Association Representing Surgical Technologists came and testified in favor of this bill. Surgical technologists themselves recognize that without any educational standard or license at stake, that they not only don't have the training, but they at this point don't feel like they have enough control over people who are in the role of surgical technologists. Literally, you or I could be a surgical technologist legally in the state. Now, possibly foolish to hire us, but that's the difference in standard between a... Representative Cameron, no way did I mean to impugn your character or talent, huh? But the difference is a licensed, trained personnel with a clear standard and accountability and someone who doesn't have that in the current legal construct.
We've had some conflicting testimony regarding the basic specialty training here and the national standards and licensures. How many of these folks are licensed in the state of Oregon as circulating nurses?
They're licensed as registered nurses, okay, with the specialty of perioperative nursing.
But there is some national licensure.
National certification. It's a voluntary national certification that we can sit for. You have to have a minimum of 2 years of experience in the operating room, as well as passing the certification examination that, I tell you, is harder than the state boards because it's focused on the specialty of perioperative nursing.
And how many folks are, Mr. Chair, if I may, how many folks are certified with this licensure, this national standards licensure in the state board?
It is a certification. It is not a licensure.
How many are there certified?
I cannot answer that at this time.
Yeah. Chair Dalto, Representative Butler, there's no requirement that you follow AORN certification. It's simply something that a nurse is wise to do, and for liability reasons, hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers are wise to hire someone with that certification, but it is completely voluntary. There's no statutory requirement for it. Any nurse can do this job under the law.
That has been appropriately trained.
I'm just anxious that we've heard that existing designated certified or circulating nurse can train other circulating nurses without any licensure. It's hospital by hospital or institution by institution. It says you have had enough experience. We believe that you ought to be a circulating nurse, and then that circulating nurse then trains other circulating nurses. I'm not sure that that gives us any level of basic standards and training. It's kind of undefined. It's like the definition of anesthesia at this point. It's just not defined in this bill.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 450 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 460. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 460 comes to us from the Senate Health Policy Committee. It left the Senate floor with 28 ayes, no noes, 2 excused votes. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, but there's no statement and there is no subsequent referral. This bill is allowing clinical nurse specialists to prescribe and dispense prescription drugs in a formulary developed by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. It limits liability of clinical nurse specialists in certain circumstances. Mr. Chair, this is adding clinical nurse specialists to the other health practitioners and their prescriptive authority. And I do have an amendment that I apologize for the lateness, but we just received it, and Martin can speak to that. Also, that I'm passing it to right now.
All right, Martin Taylor, Kelly, is it Goudreau?
Yes.
Okay, and Sherry Atherson, please. And I'd like to try to hear this bill in about 20 minutes. 25 minutes.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I will be brief. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I have with me a number of clinical nurse specialists who can speak to the specific content. I'd like to give you a quick layout of the process of this bill. This is actually an effort that started in the last legislative session, a Senate Bill 709. And in that version, it passed the Senate with 3 opposing votes and, I believe, 25 aye votes. Went to the House. It moved to the House Rules Committee on the last day of session, but failed to make it to the floor before session ended. We brought this bill to you in exactly the same form this session. That's relevant because last session a lot of work went into this, many amendments. We spent a lot of time with the Pharmacists Association in particular, making sure that there was a bill that the pharmacists were comfortable with. We've not made any changes. Substantive changes to this bill came through the committee unanimously. Senator Cruz was kind enough to carry the bill on the floor, and that comes to you. We've had some progress, some momentum, without any no votes in the Senate this time. And our hope is that over 2 years we've done our work, amended the bill, and prepared you for passing. Clinical nurse specialists are advanced practice trained nurses who are seeking similar authorities that nurse practitioners who are also advanced practice trained nurses already have. And there are differences between these two types of nurses, but the most compelling of those is that a clinical nurse specialist specializes in an area of nursing where a nurse practitioner has a more general education. Yet there's a disparity in their authorities, which we're trying to correct. That disparity largely exists because you have far fewer clinical nurse specialists in the state than you have nurse practitioners. They both perform vital functions, as I'm sure you'll hear in a moment.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Sherry Atherton, and I'm an RN, clinical nurse specialist, at the Portland VA Medical Center. I'm going to give you a verbal summary of my written testimony, which you have. I've been an RN for 20 years, and for the last 10 years, I've been a clinical nurse specialist. I have 2 patient populations. It includes the veterans that receive care in all of our acute and outpatient settings. Our outpatient settings include community-based outpatient clinics in Bend, Salem, and Astoria. I also consult with our nursing home in the Dalles. I also provide oversight and consultation for employees who provide the care of the veterans. My overall role is to prevent and control healthcare-associated infections for both groups. In the course of my work, I identify infections through analysis of the patient's records. I also work to identify ongoing current infections based on risk assessments, forecast the risk of infection for vulnerable subsets of our population. For both of these, the ability to prescribe medication to prevent and treat infections would enhance my practice. I work closely with infectious disease physicians and am in constant consultation with the interventions that we deem necessary. This frequently includes the need to prescribe medications, which they have to do. As an example, in identifying current infections, the immediate need may be for prophylaxis to prevent illness of those who have not been infected. Example, several years ago we had a very severe influenza season, and we have a nursing home, and those patients are extremely vulnerable to influenza. And when we suspected influenza in that patient population, quick intervention is called for, and I ended up doing patients' assessments and coordinating antiviral prescriptions for 90 patients and 100 susceptible employees. This had to be done quickly, and I had to pull additional MD staffing to help support getting the interventions done quickly. I also worry about impending influenza pandemic, which is likely to occur in my career. I'd be far more effective in that situation if I had the ability to prescribe antivirals. On a more routine basis, I recommend antimicrobial prophylaxis for vulnerable patient populations. It's ironic that I was here with the perioperative nurses today. One of the things that we do is prescribe medications to prevent surgical site infections. And I presented at their state conference this weekend, and one of the very drugs that is very effective for CABG patients who are diabetics. is a drug that I can't prescribe. I have to coordinate the culturing of the patient, and if they're identified to have the bug, then I have to coordinate the prescribing of that by somebody else, and it decreases the effectiveness of that intervention. It'd be more cost-efficient and more timely access to care if I could just do that whole process instead of having to delegate it. Prescriptive authority, I'm also concerned as an infection control nurse because of the impending threat of, or the ongoing threat of bioterrorism. After 911 and the subsequent anthrax scares, the ability to prophylax in that sort of situation really kind of helped heighten my urgency to obtain the ability to prescribe. As an employee in a federal facility, who would also not only be a target, but also would step up to assess the community in the event of a large event, I would be much more effective if I had the ability to prescribe. Now, I work in just one institution in the state of Oregon. We currently employ 10 clinical nurse specialists, and in talking with the other CNSs, you know, we have the returning veterans who are coming in with mental health issues. They're coming in with new exotic exposures to bugs that, you know, we are most qualified. We have the most knowledge to diagnose and treat. So I urge your support of this bill. It would make me much more effective and efficient. Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Kelly Goudreau, and I am a clinical nurse specialist. I'm also the outgoing chair of the Oregon Council of Clinical Nurse Specialists and have been working on this bill for some time. I'm hoping to see it pass as I pass out of the role of clinical nurse specialist chair. I'm also at this time the president-elect of the National Association of Clinical Nurse Specialists, and I bring to you two pieces of information, actually three. One is the information relative to some of my peers. You have before you written testimony from June Ann Cole, who is an occupational health nurse at the VA, who at this point in time is extremely frustrated by the fact that she cannot even offer someone with a twisted ankle and in an occupational health role Motrin because it is an over-the-counter medication. She needs to have prescriptive authority to be able to offer that to her patients who come to her. Very frustrating and a very baseline example of some of the things that we have to pull providers away from their other busy environment to address these issues. Another is a kind of a global statement about our clinical nurse specialist students who are graduating in this coming year. Many of them are looking at positions that offer them the opportunity to provide management of care in congestive heart failure, in pain management, in many other areas that are far too many to list for you at this time. But in every instance, the key to it is that they would be able to provide much more efficient, much greater access for patient care, and they would be able to manage their own patient load more effectively if they had the opportunity to provide prescriptive authority for those patients. Two of the things I'd like to bring to your attention in terms of the state issues are that because this is our second time through, we have in fact surveyed all of the CNSs in this state twice now, looking for support and substantiation as to why we need to have this. In both instances, a majority of the CNSs came forward saying that they needed prescriptive authority in order to be able to provide to the full extent of their experience base and to be able to manage their care of their patient load that they deal with. Further, although those folks are not able to be here themselves, they are here in spirit and in written testimony provided to both the Senate committee as well as to yourselves. The other issue is in relation to the national issues, and I wanted to let you know that there is a survey that's being conducted of all state legislatures and state boards of nursing, and at the present time, the National Association of Clinical Nurse Specialists does have information back from 34 of the 50 states. Of the 34 states, 24 of them already offer prescriptive authority for clinical nurse specialists. Those are kind of important statistics to look at out in terms of the fact that we will not be the first ones to offer this. It is a standard of care in many states, and in fact, a majority of the states that we have results back from. There are 15 more states that we're waiting for results from, and we expect to find the same kind of a differentiation, that there will be a mixture, some who do and some who don't. A piece that's important to note is that we are, within this state, we have been recognized at the national level as writing very good, very strong legislation. The legislation that was passed previously that recognizes protected title for clinical nurse specialists is in fact being used as model language in other states, and the National Association of Clinical Nurse Specialists has offered that as language that can be taken and modeled and used in other states. It's expected that the language of Senate Bill 460, if passed into law, will also be used in that manner, because it does very clearly provide the option of prescriptive authority for those who need it and desire it and would have benefit from it for their patients and their patient care. The voice, the message is clearly, please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who's best to answer the question, and it's one that you and I have discussed in the past. Passing legislation is always a combination of politics and policy. And while I think there's no question that the clinical nurse specialists need this, expanding who has prescribing privileges is always a complicated matter, because there's three others behind you that want to be the next one. I think in everything that you describe and that I hear, clinical nurse specialists are a form of nurse practitioner. They, in fact, are no different than nurse practitioners, except they're specialists as opposed to generalists. Why can't we just define clinical nurse specialists as nurse practitioners and already give them the prescribing privileges that are in the statute for nurse practitioners?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlake, there is a distinction in both the scope of practice as defined by the Board of Nursing and in the cultures of nurse practitioners and clinical nurse specialists. Although we were given a 20-minute clock, and I have a colleague who I'm sure would be happy to give you that entire explanation, I'm just not sure it's a 20-minute conversation. I would say that for the purposes of this bill, that's not the bill in front of you to merge clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners. The real question that this bill is asking is, if they have comparable education in pharmacology and a comparable need for their patients to have their services to include prescribing, why are we treating them differently? And
that's my question. Right. Why are we defining them differently is my question.
And the very abbreviated answer to the difference between them is really in how they see their role with a patient. And I think that their clinical nurse specialists both specialize but also have a understanding of themselves that's closer to the research and the academics of nursing, where the nurse practitioners are primarily focused on direct patient care, which is why you see many clinical nurse specialists not going out into when nurse practitioners frequently open their own clinics. A lot of clinical nurse specialists work in education, they work in research, they work in administration of hospitals, so there's a slightly different emphasis on their career paths. But I could give you a longer, I could bring Sue Davidson right up here and she could.
Those three things, the education, research, and administration, is that what they require the prescribing privileges for?
If I can respond,
yes.
Actually,
yes.
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlake, the discussion about clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners was one that was held by the advanced practice nurses ourselves many years ago in looking at the variation in the roles and how we function. That was decided at a national level that clinical nurse specialists and nurse practitioners are and do have differentiated practice. I don't know that that's I understand your confusion and perhaps your effort to make this.
I'm not confused, actually. Thank you.
Your efforts.
I have a clearer vision than you have about the issue here. In fact,
I appreciate your efforts and do understand your perspective. But I would ask also that the committee would consider that we are the clinical nurse specialists and respectively the nurse practitioners, and that we have identified clearly that there is a distinct difference between our roles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kelly, I do support this bill. It's just that it seems to me this is the hard way to do it. And if it fails again, this time my recommendation is you think about how to join your sisters and brothers who basically already have this privilege.
Chair Delta, members of the committee, just ever so briefly, I was remiss in not explaining that you had amendments as well. And the amendments are very simple. They simply allow the Board of Nursing to levy an appropriate fee to cover the new responsibilities they'll have to certify the dispensing for clinical nurse specialists. We all support it, including the board.
Okay. We have the amendments here. We will take a look at them. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sue Davidson. Is Sue still here? Good morning. Welcome.
Chair D'Alto, members of the committee. I am Sue Davidson, the Assistant Executive Director for Practice, Education, and Research of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'll make it short. I'll make it sweet. I hope you pass this bill out. CNSs need this. They want it. And there is support for it in the CNS committee and community and in the nurse practitioner community. That group has supported us, and at some time in the past, a decision was made between the two groups not to go the route of an advanced practice nurse. That decision was made in collaboration with one another, and although your vision of the future is different, it seems to me this is not the bill that would accomplish that goal. So with all due respect to you, Representative Greenlich, I strongly urge the committee to pass the bill, and thank you for your time.
Okay. Thanks very much. With that, we will close the public... Oh. That's kind of how that works.
I don't know.
Teresa Teeter.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
You'll have to pardon me. I was just made aware of this bill this morning, and so it's very important that I come in front of you right now regarding this bill.
All right. You might start by introducing yourself.
Yes. My name is Teresa Teeter. I'm a resident of Oregon City, Oregon, Clackamas County. I've just recently filed two major lawsuits in federal court regarding the application of non-FDA-approved drugs given to me, and upon receiving them, I received them from a nurse practitioner at Clackamas County Mental Health, and a year earlier, I'd received, so I had post-traumatic stress disorder when I walked in. I was given Paxil a year earlier for the same chronic post-traumatic stress. Then I walked in again 6-7 months later, and I'm given Paxil and Neurontin. Neurontin's for epileptic seizures. Now, I'm concerned with some, I had adverse effects, suicide attempts, and then I had additional non-FDA drugs given to me through that county facility that's funded by your Oregon health plan that your OMAP office didn't regulate properly. So, anyway, you have a lot of things that I feel that you should be applying the FDA word to on your last page, and it's things on like line 19, number 7, no manufacturer or wholesaler shall sell, otherwise distribute, offer. I had a discussion with a representative at Pioneer Square the other day from Navoric when they were doing a pharmaceutical thingy where the reps were trying to give some more non-FDA drugs out in this state, and I asked the rep, are you aware of your company having any lawsuit filed against it for false misrepresentation of its products? And no, I'm just hired off the street and told to sell this stuff. Hello. Welcome to Oregon. And government assisted suicide program that I went through for the last 5.5 years. Thank you. Yes, your state offices were all aware of my complaints on this and didn't shut down Clackamas County Mental Health or the public health, who gave me these 4 off-label drugs, of one which is now in a lawsuit. You need on number 7, you manufacture a wholesaler, you need to get the word rep in there. You need to get down here on line 35. The term shall not constitute dispensing. Well, if you're handing somebody a drug that's been made by a biochemical manufacturing corporation, you're dispensing it, whether you've paid for it, received it in a prescription or not. You're handing somebody something lethal. I don't like that terminology. So if I wouldn't be able to sue the nurse for giving it to me, But somehow she loaded the gun with the bullet. Who gave her the bullet? Am I just supposed to shoot the gun manufacturer that created the gun, and then the bullet maker's not responsible for its defective bullet or whatever that killed me? I don't get it. There's a lot of wording in here on these last two pages that I don't go with at all. Like line 7 on the last page, section 9, line 3, no person shall adulterate for the purpose of sale any drug in such manner as to render it injurious to health, knowingly sell. You've got United States Attorney Spitzer in New York right now who's filed a major lawsuit against pharmaceutical companies saying you are a violation of the First Amendment where you use... You take the First Amendment and manipulate it to sell your product and lie to the persons, and those of us that did kill ourselves on Neurontin, et cetera, have no, you know, we didn't know this. So I don't know what your terminology for adulterate is. Do you need to get the word misrepresent into that sentence as well for protections? Because I sat upstairs and testified on your Vioxx bill to try to get the statute of limitations to cover all drugs in this state and to include it up to 7 to 10 years. So if you don't have the word misrepresent, represent. See, I don't know what adulterate means. I'd have to go look up this Oregon statute thing, and I just got this morning. So adulterate, in my opinion, means to commit fraud, you know, husband-wife thingy. But I'm not sure what it means. But if you falsely misrepresent and promote it, it should be in here, because that's what the premise of my Pfizer lawsuit is. Falsely misrepresent and promote. That's coming into Oregon committing a crime with a product. So I'm thinking you folks need to look over some of this before you start passing it on. Talk to your legal people. And then one more big thing over here on page 2. Let's see. It's part of the section 2, but on page 2, line number 3. When it talks about a health practitioner may claim limitation on liability provided by the section only if the health practitioner obtains patient's informed consent. Because I was doing research on the nurse practitioner who didn't tell me while I was in the throes of post-traumatic stress and couldn't make a properly informed consent. I got this off the internet the other day. And it says, this is from the Medical Journal of Australia, Truth in Clinical Research Trials. This is regarding informed consent. Patients should be aware that clinical trials, et cetera, that there's things hidden in clinical trials. Producer Dick Wolf showed this on a TV show just recently, like CSI or something, where the doctor, where the pharmaceutical company put the product out, but he only wanted the doctor to report back the positive aspects of the clinical trial. And the doctor made money off this, and the person got hurt. So, if your informed consent thing under here, you know, I'm not understanding how this, you know, what I wrote in the margin is that there should be no limitation on criminal or civil liability if informed consent was manipulated or misrepresented. Is there a way you can get that wording in there? Because if this sentence should apply to a health practitioner who's doing kickbacks under the table or something, you know, you got to think way far out of the box on this legislation.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate your concerns.
Do you want me to write out these suggestions for amendments?
If you'd like to, we'd be happy to accept.
Okay, because I just got this morning, so it would still have time to be included for consideration.
Absolutely.
Okay, because this is very detailed stuff. This involves liability law back to you guys, too.
Well, if you want to take a moment and write your thoughts out and
I'll
recommendations,
go to the
you can give them to staff. Okay.
Thank you very much. Representatives. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 460 and stand adjourned.